This episode of Datanauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code DATANAUTS30.
Serverless is made of servers, or so the meme goes. Is that all there is to it for serverless as far as infrastructure engineering is concerned? A cheap dismissal, a witty meme, and that's about it. Or does the idea of serverless applications represent a concern for infrastructure engineers? Join the Datanauts as we blast through the hot aisle, rip open a rack door, and peer inside to see just what serverless is made of. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks, and back from his journey of self-discovery at an invitation-only hot yoga retreat in fabulous Tijuana, Mexico, is my co-host Chris Wall at Chris Wall. Datanauts is part of the Packet Pushers Podcast Network. To find every Datanauts podcast, along with lots of other shows for IT engineers, go to packetpushers.net. Serverless. What is serverless, really? For me, this was like, I just started getting annoyed seeing references and articles to serverless and on Twitter and the jokes about, you know, well, serverless is made of servers. Huh? And I'm like, okay, well, what is this thing? There's always some buzzword that means something. What is the substance to it? Chris, I read a bunch of articles and I'm going to take a stab here at a definition based on all of the different blog articles I read because they all led me to kind of the same place. So I thought it would be safe to define it in the way I read it. And then you tell me what you think, if I'm wrong here. To get to what serverless is, I think first of all, we have to say, what do we mean by server? And in the context of serverless, I think server actually means an operating system executing some service, not a physical piece of hardware like an HP server or whatever, you know, this physical thing you rack, but it's actually, from a developer standpoint, an OS that has got some server running on it. Not really the hardware. I mean, yeah, hardware is implied, but it kind of doesn't matter for what we're talking about when we talk about serverless. The important thing here is a developer would have previously stood up some process and then fired data at it, and that process would be running on some manageable, tangible infrastructure that we're familiar with. Does that sound about right to you, Chris, or do you have a different take on it?
Well, it's definitely been a joyous ride through Twitter to watch all of the memes be generated. I love when these new marketing terms come out because rage against what they are. But yes, it is serverless, not compute-less.
Right.
That's where I think some people get a little fuzzy, myself included. You know, I mean, calling something serverless as a longtime infrastructure server plumber, that's basically what I am. The idea of having something that is serverless does seem at first blush kind of stupid, but I would agree for the most part with your definition. There's no contained unit that is really associated with the workload. I think that's really the key. It's not about getting rid of virtual machines or physical or whatnot. It's really just saying, I want to run some bit of code, some function or service or whatever it is, but I don't really want to know, nor do I really care unless I'm putting some parameters around where it runs. And I think we did blush on that a little bit when we talked to the folks at CoreOS, and they were talking about, you know, just throw it at a host and it gets run by some kind of scheduler. And you don't really know about that. You don't sit there and say, this is going to run on node 7. That's where it runs until it dies. You just say, throw it at the cluster, throw it at some kind of group of abstraction of compute, and it'll run there. And you don't really have to know about that.
Although I think serverless takes it a bit further. Again, just based on my reading and research, this seems to all go back to the AWS, Amazon Web Services, Lambda service. And in that construct with Lambda, you don't need to spin up a VM or container or anything else via scheduler or otherwise for some formal process to be running on. You end up firing your data at this function that's been created in Lambda instead. And there's a whole guide for developers on how to build functions in Lambda, etc. Once you've got that function stood up, that function is integrated into cloud services on the back end. It scales automatically depending on load, which does feel very much like a scheduler, you know, like the things we talked about in that CoreOS show with Alex.
Yeah.
And so to my way of thinking, Lambda's adding more to it so that it's kind of like the ultimate abstraction. To create and consume a function, you genuinely never think about infrastructure. You just interact with Lambda and it does all the scaling for you on the back end. It's quite magical. Maybe I'm splitting hairs here, but to me, it even takes away the private cloud infrastructure that we'd be building.
I don't know. I mean, to me, it's all about who is the wizard behind the curtain and who's Dorothy, right? If you're walking in and consuming the service, yeah, it's magic and it's abstracted and you have no idea what's running on it. But someone's building that environment, and I assume someone's going to want to put that private at some point. realistically, you're throwing code somewhere and something is running it. There's some container service something that actually executes the code. Maybe you just can't see that. But we've had similar offerings with platform as a service with things like Elastic Beanstalk, where you just say, here's my code. And obviously, Beanstalk was specific to one language that kind of abstracted the platform away so you could just use it. But that idea of just saying, I don't know anything about the infrastructure, nor do I care because there's really smart folks that are handling that for me. And I'm just going to throw my code against it like spaghetti on the wall and see what happens. That's nothing new, I would say. This seems a little less language specific and a little more function oriented to me. That's the shift.
Yes. So I tried to read some very developer-oriented articles. Now, I'm not a developer. I have some programming background, but it is pretty hard for me to keep up with the language and concerns of a modern application designer, developer person. But still, I was able to pull some information out. And what you just said about functions being the key thing seems exactly right. I saw some diagrams where they'd say, okay, so before serverless, our application architecture looked like this. And they would show a workflow, a request coming in, maybe some services along the way like authentication and a database call and web request having to get farmed out to different processes and how that looked. And they said, okay, well, now with serverless, look, here in the authentication, we replaced what we would have had as a direct server call with this function now that's been written in Lambda. And look, it scales out automatically, does all these things, and we didn't have to think about it. We don't care. We just fire that data, this function up in the public cloud instead. I mean, is it really on the back end different? It isn't, no, but it's the public cloud that's extracting it. And by the way, we're talking about AWS Lambda, but one of the articles I read mentioned that there's also IBM OpenWhisk, there's Google Cloud Functions, there's Azure Functions, and other services as well that can do this kind of thing. This is a big thing, not just in Amazon, but all over the place. Again, serverless, it almost feels like a stupid thing to say, but again, from a developer perspective, that's what this is all about.
Well, I think you tickled upon the part that's probably relevant to the audience and certainly to me. Is this a threat? Is this something I need to learn, focus on? And realistically, to me, all of these things are worth paying attention to some degree. They're all quote-unquote threats, although I think the best way to flip it on its head is look at it as an opportunity. Realistically, cloud is a thing. Public cloud is a thing. People want to consume it. All the C-levels are like, yes, let's get in the cloud. It's like renting a car. You know, I don't know if you'd want to do that forever, but it can be cost advantageous for a short period of time. So yes, you want to look at these things because it further enhances that idea of leveraging someone else's data center, being called public cloud by way of APIs and services and things like that to further the, I guess, reach of your private data center and what you're doing there. And frankly, people are demanding it. So you either get on the train or you get hit by the train. It's your choice.
Sponsorship break, folks. We're going to talk about IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV gives you access to the most important tools needed to prepare you for IT certification. I've been to the site. I visited. I viewed a number of the videos. It is the real deal. You get 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content. New courses are added every single week. And you can consume these courses either live, because they're actually running live sessions you can tune into, or on demand. You can look at the archives, go through the library, and pick anything you want to. And you can view these with anything that you can imagine. Chromecast, Roku, Amazon, Fire TV, etc. Of course, through the web in a browser or with your mobile device. Now, if you've heard this ad before, listen up. Here's some new stuff. IT Pro TV is now the first IT video provider with courses for sale through Amazon Video Direct. So subscriptions are still going to be the best value for you, but it's kind of cool that IT Pro TV is now available for purchase directly on Amazon. Now, if you're wondering, why do I care? What content have they got? They've got all the big stuff, the big names, like Microsoft Server 2016, MCSE. They cover ethical hacking. They get into virtualization, a lot of VMware content in there, cryptography, Metasploit, other such things that would be of immediate value to you if you're an infrastructure or security engineer, etc. Now, June courses, content that they've added here includes CCNA security from Cisco, VMware's VCP6, and then instructor Adam Gordon returns with Certified Ethical Hacker version 9. It's not just course material you get with IT Pro TV. You also get well over 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs and then Transcender practice exams so that you know you're really ready to go take the real thing. And that's $109 value. All of that
is rolled into one low monthly subscription price. And if you decide at some point, I don't want this anymore, they have a no-hassle cancellation policy. And by the way, corporate group pricing is available. Check out itpro.tv/datanauts to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANAUTS30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/datanauts. Use the code DATANAUTS30 and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account.
All right, Ethan, we're on the train now because we decided not to get hit by it, I suppose. I feel like a little dent in my side. But anyways, let's talk about use cases for serverless. Oh, I just even hate saying that word. But let's talk about what are we going to use it for? And my opinion, first off, is I don't know yet. It seems a little early. We're still trying to figure out microservices and re-architecting our applications to run fragmented all over the place with no shared fate. So this seems like, hey, let's scratch the surface and see if this sticks somewhere and who starts using it. I'm sure there's people that are consuming it, but we're not ripping out vast swaths of our private data centers to put this in just yet. Where are you thinking this is headed towards?
Well, it's certainly not a mature technology, right? A lot of hype about it. People are writing articles and, oh my gosh, serverless is so exciting. We're at that point, you know, kind of the rising part of the hype cycle. Use cases for an infrastructure engineer, we're not the people consuming this. The people consuming this are developers. And so it's developers that are looking at this going, oh, I can write my code and structure my application projects in such a way that I don't have to worry about infrastructure at all because Lambda functions are going to handle all that magically for me on the back end, which isn't too far from what we would be doing with a properly designed private cloud with a schedule anyway, as we brought up earlier. So the way I see this, serverless is the ultimate divorce of code from infrastructure, just complete abstracting away of that physical element of things. And so I see it as a reliance on Lambda or whoever you're consuming, but let's just say Lambda, that does seem to be the most popular serverless service, to keep and maintain that serverless abstraction layer. I don't know that I read anywhere, think of it as an abstraction layer. It's just kind of how I'm viewing it because it's really what it is. This function is abstracting away all of the infrastructure underneath. So if you're a developer, is that interesting? Well, there's a lot of people writing and talking about it, and it's got their advantages for them. So again, by abstraction, I'm talking about that functional interface that the developers are interacting with that magically handles that infrastructure element. I got to say, thinking through this, is like this feels like a vendor lock-in scenario to me. I mean, when you're consuming public cloud with their specific methods and so on, there's certainly an element of that anyway, just like any vendor product. But this felt a little vendor lock-in to me. So I was wondering if, no matter what the use cases are, is this a scary thing? You know, yet a deeper dependence on public cloud and a specific way of doing things in a particular public cloud that makes our applications less portable over time.
That's always been Amazon's game, right? Offer solutions that are proprietary to their public cloud offering, the various stacks that they have for you to consume, and then you just start consuming them. And if there's no alternative offering that's frictionless to move between from their offering to someone else's, you are kind of locked in. But at the same time, I don't know, ringing the cowbell of vendor lock-in just feels a little hollow to me. Simply because if we are writing code that can kind of be executed wherever and you're writing its functions, then it feels like the days of S3, and it was like, oh, cool, this object store, and everyone else just wrote emulation for S3. So S3 compatible and tests for S3 is kind of universal. It went from this kind of specific service that they offered to kind of a generic, everyone loved it, so it became commoditized kind of thing. If enough adoption occurs, I think there'll be some compatibility layers written for it. But to your earlier point, this seems like it's not where you necessarily are going to run all of production. Maybe it's just pre-prod, you're putting the code together. Plus, you can't abstract away all of the WAN considerations and user authentication and security and how do you protect the data once it's been written there. And there's so many more considerations than just here's where I run the compute, things happen, you know, a wizard comes around and eats a chicken leg. It's more about the whole ecosystem, right? Plus, what if you're a shop that doesn't really have developers on-prem? What if you're just offering some kind of solution and this isn't your kind of bag? Are you still going to consume something like this? If you're a warehouse or just doing manufacturings or something like that, is this even up your alley? I don't know. It seems like a specific use case for folks that have an army of devs, or at least a substantial number of them, that need a place to write code without us silly plumbers getting in their way.
Yes. And so from that standpoint, this is a smart thing for Amazon Web Services to be offering, right? Going back to your earlier point, it's been Amazon's game for a long time. Keep bringing them in. Look what you can do now on our platform. It is astonishing, and you will love it as a developer. Speed of deployment, brand new kind of application architecture. So developers have got to look at this and go, yay, if I can get they can wrap their brains around it, this is going to be really cool for them. And at the same time for Amazon, what's happening on the back end? There's Amazon compute infrastructure that's getting spun up, and that creates revenue for Amazon Web Services. Consumer functions with Lambda, and there's money tied to that. Obviously, this isn't a free thing. So it's not merely hosting in the Amazon cloud, running compute in the Amazon cloud. Now it's a whole new way to consume the Amazon cloud, different from what you did before, easier to consume, with a great big wonderful guide to integration that explains as a developer how you need to consume this. And so now more AWS is being consumed, more pennies per hour, however much it is hitting your bill. The code seems to be separated from the infrastructure, right? But I don't know about the code portability. Now, you said maybe that's a red herring, because if it's popular enough, it'll become portable. Everyone will just kind of use it as the default standard. But maybe it's not that hard. I mean, I saw descriptors written in JSON, and maybe it's just as simple as changing a descriptor file to be able to move your code somewhere else. So maybe you're right. Maybe it's not such a big deal to get your code moved somewhere else. But so going to go back to our original question, though. Use cases. It's developer-driven, and as you were saying, is this where you do modeling because it's easy and so on? I don't know from what I was reading from the developer side of life that that was the intent. They were actually changing application architectures to leverage functions within their app flow, and it made it look like, well, before we would have run this and spun it up in a process on a server and hit that process. Now we're just firing in a Lambda function. And that was like, and we've changed the application architecture. It didn't feel like, oh, well, here's a cool little thing that we can use kind of off to the side when we're in dev, but we'd never do it in prod this way. It looked like a new application architecture that was intended to be a production function.
Good. I'm glad you said that, because that makes a lot more sense. It feels like these really lightweight little fire and forget, almost like message bus kind of stuff. Like, hey, do this thing, come back, return a value, let me know how it worked out, chain it together, and you've got a service. Which makes sense, because then you're not just having this virtual machine sitting there going, I'm eating CPU, doing nothing, and charging you, what do you say, pennies per hour or dollars per hour?
Whatever it is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the governance of trying to make sure that the cloud is running lean and mean, because you want to squeeze every penny out of it that you can, is non-trivial. And so if you're just kind of paying per action or function or whatever, or subscribing that kind of model, it seems a lot more consumable, assuming that you've written the app stack to run in that fashion.
I think the final question worth asking on a podcast like this, which is really aimed at infrastructure engineers, is how can an infrastructure engineer make serverless perform better? So if we think about what serverless is, there's some bit of code that's being fired at a function running in the public cloud, and then there's some set of answers coming back. I think whether or not infrastructure engineers can have any impact on serverless and how it functions is going to depend a whole lot on the application architecture. And again, I'm going to go back to, we've had several conversations on DataKnots about hybrid cloud and what that looks like when you've got some of your infrastructure in-house and some of your infrastructure hosted out in the cloud, because of latency concerns and speed concerns and path redundancy concerns and understanding where specific functions that depend on one another live, so that when they are making calls one to another, we are minimizing latency and therefore minimizing the impact to user experience, because we're not waiting a long time for a call to go from one part of the public cloud to maybe another part, or back to our home and data center, back and forth and so on. So that's a thought. Where are the application calls to a Lambda function being made? Is it all happening in public cloud? Well, we can't impact that as an infrastructure engineer, right? Because that's all away from us. What if the calls are being made internally or on our private cloud to something that is up in the public cloud? We're not breaking any new ground here, right? I mean, if this is effectively a hybrid cloud deployment that happens to be using serverless as part of the application architecture, nothing's different. The same concerns that we would have had in any hybrid cloud environment are still true here. Latency is the enemy. If you call a function, network latency implies an added delay component. So there's a possible user experience impact there. And so we want to be aware of those things, work with application architects to explain that element of things to them and see what we can do to minimize that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I tend to go back to the impact of config management, automation. How can I actually build a cloud? You know, a lot of people have virtualized infrastructures and it magically becomes a cloud. No. So it's not trivial to create and consume cloud resources, especially on-prem. It seems like with this particular model, we're making it even more frictionless to say, okay, I want to consume cloud resources, and now I can just kind of throw some code at it, I can get out of the way. I think what you're saying resonates for me, except I tend to focus less on the network aspects, which are certainly important. I'm not trying to downplay that, and more at the data aspects. And when I think of where is the data going to live, you know, the concept of data gravity, and that where the data live tends to pull compute towards it because it's hard to move data around the world. And there's actually speed of light limitations. So we will hit a point where we just cannot go faster, theoretically. Where is that data going to live? How are we going to do something against the data? You know, is this the kind of application stack where we don't care that much? Is it super tiny? How do we keep coherency across the different data repositories? And I saw a lot of the new generation of databases being referenced in a lot of the articles talking about serverless. Perhaps the data just is out there somewhere in one of these kind of NoSQL distributed type databases anyways. And then that makes me think of the lock-in cowbell that I mentioned earlier that you were talking about, Ethan, where, man, now I've got my data in a service that may be proprietary using a function that may be proprietary. They're just licking their chops and rubbing their hands. You can go back to your little Transylvanian accent there for the folks at Amazon. There's definitely a lot of concerns, but ultimately I kind of like it because let's say you're going to look at public cloud anyways, right? You're looking at maybe consuming some services out there or building something with Azure Stack or something like that where it's kind of co-located, maybe rental public cloud kind of thing. This seems like a great way to just get rid of all of that, assuming you have the talent in-house that can understand the architecture for the app and, I guess, port things over or create new for those apps and start using them. You know, like those little IoT buttons that order more dishwashing detergent and things like that for your washer-dryer system. You just press the button, it does an API call to buy more crap from Amazon. This feels like that, but for services.
Another infrastructure concern, Chris, I'll throw at you and see if you have an opinion here, because this is something I couldn't really glean from the articles, but I had a thought. When you build a typical application architecture, you know, let's forget about serverless for the moment, but you need to track state. Very often for a lot of apps, you got to track state. That could be a load balancer. Now we're moving towards stateless applications where that's much less of an issue. Yes, I understand that, but is this a thing that we need to worry about in serverless? Do you need to track state of queries up to the Lambda service where that function lives? Or is this a dev problem? I mean, I guess it feels like a dev problem because the way Lambda describes itself, those functions are supposed to auto-scale, which kind of implies a statelessness to it if it's auto-scaling. You don't need a load balancer to access these functions. You're not firing a call at a load balancer. You're firing a call at the function directly. And you don't need a proxy, doesn't appear. Again, you're doing calls right to that Lambda function directly. It all just sort of happens. Thinking about these architects, like, oh my gosh, I'd want my Lambda service to be, you know, redundant. I'm going to hide it behind a load balancer and all these sorts of things, doesn't seem to factor in. Nor does it factor in where we see a lot of container architectures where there's some kind of a proxy server off on a load balancer sitting right out in front governing conversations and load distributed across the different container infrastructures. So again, I'm just trying to figure out where does the infrastructure engineer improve serverless? And again, going back to my networking side of the house, that silo, thinking about load balancing, I didn't really see a big fit there, a big need there. Would you agree with that from what you know of serverless?
Yeah, I think load balancing is definitely a way that you can turn non-distributed, more monolithic-y apps into semi-distributed. It almost reminded me of like LACP. You know, you're taking these layer two links and making them look like they're one, that kind of thing. In reality, though, the distributed nature of a lot of these databases and Cassandra and a lot of these other more modern ways of sharing data that's semi-stateless, you know, kind of eventual consistency, handles a lot of that.
Yes.
It's not really a huge concern. But I think back to the what can I offer as an infrastructure engineer? We have a lot of experience with building these resilient environment architectures. So if you look at combining policy and compliance and auditing and how do we make sure this stuff is resilient in multiple different ways. You're talking about the network. I'm talking more about the data services. But all of those things that are typically why I think the devs want to move out of these flaming dumpster fires that they have in their internal labs, because they're just, they're run in that kind of nature where there's no infrastructure team necessarily playing with them, or they swipe their credit card and they use an Amazon, and you're looking at these virtual private clouds that are just run horribly. It's a any allowed kind of thing, and you're just weeping when you look at it. It's abstracting away even that stuff. So we can provide some information on governance and compliance and data services and things like that, so that we make sure the environment is protected properly and that you can get to it with low latency, as you bring up, and all the normal stuff that you'd have to do to get to the public cloud anyways. But in this case, a lot of the complexity that we'd have to spend with config management and actually, you know, maybe putting this behind a cloud management portal is gone, which is kind of a cool thing. You know, it's less stuff I have to deal with. It's just point them over here, make sure you're backed up or something like that, and away you go, which I kind of like.
Well, I think the next phase for Datanauts and serverless is to get someone on the show who's done some work in the space that can maybe talk to us. Maybe we break down those silos even further and get a developer on the show, that as long as they can speak enough infrastructure that we can have a good conversation. That would be a fun place to take this next, because of course this was just exploratory for us.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I like the concept. I would like to get deeper and nerdier with it. We shouldn't shy away from these things. You know, whether or not it makes it or not is really irrelevant for me. It's an interesting topic. And I feel that as a combined whole, as infrastructure engineers, the army of darkness that we are, we should definitely keep an eyeball on this sort of stuff, because there's a lot of tips and tricks that I found that are being used with this kind of architecture and in the dev world that I love to copycat and steal and put into my bag of tools. So this is no exception. I'm pretty interested to get someone that's using this in production, or at least playing around with it, to kind of help bridge that gap between infrastructure engineer and developer.
Well, thanks for listening to the show today. And that concludes today's brief, but hopefully informative, Datanauts podcast. And if nothing else, you should have come away with a good definition in your mind, a good idea of what serverless is really all about, other than the memes that you giggle at. So you can reach me. I am at EC Banks on Twitter. My blog is ethancbanks.com. Chris is at Chris Wahl on Twitter, and his blog is wahlnetwork.com. And if you didn't know, Wahl, W-A-H-L. Okay. For more timely and technical Datanauts podcast, aim your intergalactic two-way transceiver towards the Milky Way galaxy and tune in packetpushers.net. If you're in our universe blasting through hyperspace in your aluminum falcon, give us a review on iTunes or shout out to @datanauts_show on Twitter. We appreciate the love. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed. Look at you levels go. You reporting to as well, also, too?
What were you trying to say there? Because it sounds like you called me Toto almost.
Man. That's perfect. Great.
Pig nipples, you know?